I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. So last week, our weekly podcast had a slightly different format because I was off at the American Renaissance Conference. So Mike and John interviewed Ference Almasi, and that was a very interesting interview. I finally had a chance to listen to it the other day. So anyway, we're back to our normal schedule, our normal format this time. And I'd like to begin just by thanking our donators, and we have 2 weeks worth of donations to thank people for. So again, I will read first names of people as long as it's not such an unusual first name that it's practically a doxing of somebody. If it's a common first name, I'm just going to read it aloud. So we received $200 from Justin. Thank you very much. $20 from Jonathan. $10 from Michael. $20 from Daniel. $10 from Martin. $30 from John. $40 from Rolf. $10 from Peter. $50 from Tim, $120 from another John, $200 from Emil, $20 from James, $10 from Nick, $10 from A, $100 from Jonathan, $30 from another Nick, $10 from Alex, $20 from Derek, $20 from Andrew, $50 from Jeff, another $50 from Thomas, $5 from Brian, $10 from William, $10 from yet another Michael, $20 from another Brian, $20 from Christopher, $180 from Dingo Land, $10 from Morgan, $20 from Shane, $10 from James, $10 from Chris, $10 from Nate, $5 from Michael, yet another Michael, $10 from Katie, $30 from Kathleen, $30 from Brian, $20 from Mark, $20 from Jason, $100 from Hunt, and $20 from Thomas. Another $10 from a Robert, $150 from Jeremy. Thank you very much for that. It's a first-time donation. $10 from Cody, $10 from Kevin, $20 from Miles, $10 from Alton, $14.88 from Matthew, $20 from Robert, $200 from another Robert, $300 from Jeff, thank you very much for that, $100 from Omar, $10 from Lana, and $20 from Ben. And I didn't even have time to add that all up, but it's a very substantial amount of support. So thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, for your continued support of Countercurrents.
Yes, thanks from all of us.
So I thought that what we would do today is talk about two things. One, my review of Christopher Nolan's new movie, Dunkirk, went kind of viral, and it's gotten some links in more mainstream blogs. It got linked at Tyler Cowen's Marginal Revolution, and that sort of set things off. And then it got linked most recently at National Review Online. The other thing I'd like to talk about, maybe if you guys have any questions about it, is the recent American Renaissance Conference from which I just returned. That was just last weekend. So I guess let's talk a little bit about Amarin first. Do you guys want me to fill you in on anything?
Well, I was just curious about, I mean, this is really the first Amarin since last November when everything sort of changed. I mean, I realize that Amarin isn't exactly alt-right, but it's sort of paleo alt-right, if you will. So I understand that there were a lot more young people there, because I was there 3 years ago. And I would say it was mostly people older than me, and I was 40 when I was there. So what was your assessment of it this year?
No, I just wanted to fill in. I was actually there last year, and the age was substantially lower than it had been in previous years I'd attended. When I was there last year, it was perhaps my first time going in about 5 or 6 years. So I could already tell a big difference there. And there was a lot of enthusiasm last year about Trump and the election and anticipation of his victory. At that point already, people were optimistic about his chances for winning the whole thing. So I had a real blast last year. And I imagine it sounds like from reading Aiden's recent article that it's gotten even younger and more optimistic about our collective future, if not about the Trump presidency in particular.
Well, there were 300 guests. I guess it was limited to 300 guests, and I don't know if that was 300 plus the speakers and the staff or just 300 people total, but it was a large crowd. Everywhere you looked, there were people. And that was apparently their largest crowd ever. I have not been to Ameren since 2008, so I don't have much of a benchmark to go from. I have not seen a lot of the changes since 2008. However, it was a fairly young audience, and a significant percentage of the people there had never been to an American Renaissance conference before, so that was a positive sign. What I did when I got there is, when the conference started officially on Saturday morning, I had two assistants, my friend George and also Aiden Cassiel, and we went in and set up the countercurrents table right next to the American Renaissance table in a very sort of central position in the actual room where all the speeches took place, so we could man the table and listen to the speeches, which was a good setup. I much preferred that to being out in a hallway somewhere or a lobby somewhere while the speeches went on. So I was fully prepared to miss every speech, but I got to see most of them. I skipped out on a few of them, primarily because I needed to meet with people. I gave a couple of interviews to journalists. One entailed me missing John Derbyshire's speech, and I was also a little ill on Sunday morning, honestly. And so I skipped out on a lot of the Sunday morning stuff. And I also gave another interview on Sunday morning as well. But it was, overall, it was a good setup. I had access to a lot of people. And I generally just sort of held court at the countercurrents table when I wasn't running off to do an interview or go to a meeting or something. And when I wasn't there, we had George and Aiden there. And they were really, really good. Neither of them had manned a book table before, but they knew the countercurrents books. And they were tall, well-dressed, presentable guys, and they were really good at selling books. So that was great. I met a lot of our readers. I met some of our donors. I hung out with some of our writers because there were a number of countercurrents writers there. I made a lot of new friends and a lot of new contacts. I deepened some contacts and friendship at the event as well. It was a very, very intellectually stimulating time. The best talks by my lights, I guess, were the talks by, well, first of all, Jared Taylor and Peter Brimlow have been at many of these conferences, obviously. Jared's been at every one of them. And I thought they gave really good talks. I valued them tremendously. And I thought of the new people to American Renaissance, the best speakers were Martin Lichtmetz, who is a German New Right figure and a friend of mine, and also my friend and Countercurrents' own writer, Julian Langness. Julian gave the after-dinner speech. He was sort of the keynoter, which came as a surprise when I got the printed program. And I said, wow, this is a real, real honor. Julian's first talk was at the Northwest Forum last fall. And now he's headlining at Ameren. So that's a really big step up. And he did an excellent job. And he spoke very well to the millennial crowd. And I have to say, the guy had a great suit, too. It was a great suit. It looked quite good. So anyway, he did a great job. So I, overall, thought it was an incredibly stimulating time. I brought 5.5 boxes of books, and I went home with 1.5 boxes of books. So we sold almost 80% of the books that we brought, which was really quite good. Sometimes you go to these conferences and you have a book table and you sell 5 or 7 books, and it's like a huge amount of effort, and expense to mail a bunch of books to there and then to send most of them back. Whereas I was not stuck with a lot of books to mail back. So that was quite encouraging as well.
That sounds like it was really good then.
Yeah. I think it was certainly, it was my best Ameren experience. I've been to 4 Ameren conferences now. I went in 2002, the first time. I went in 2006, and I went in 2008. And Ameren 2017 was definitely the best experience. And I'm going to be definitely back at Ameren 2018. I enjoyed it. People sought me out. People wanted to buy my stuff, our stuff, Countercurrents books. And that means that we'll be back. It was a very welcoming environment and a really good experience. And Aidan put it in his piece very nicely. He said it was like going to a revival meeting, a Christian revival meeting, and coming out of there with a huge shot of good morale. It was a morale boosting experience for all involved. Everyone was exhausted when it was all over, just because when you're so stimulated, you don't get a lot of sleep.
I guess they're capped out now at 300 attendees. I read on the American Renaissance website that it was due to the fire regulations, actually,
right,
at the state park where they had the event. So
they're going to have to find a new location.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to be a big task. But they could have had more than 400 people if they didn't have that cap. So obviously there was a great deal of interest in this.
I'm just curious, though, Greg. It's been almost a decade since your last one, and how has it changed since 2008?
Well, it hasn't changed in terms of the format, and some of the speakers haven't changed. The basic AMREN formula hasn't changed. But I think the audience on average was younger at this one than at the previous ones that I attended. When I first went, it was like going to church. There were lots of gray heads in the audience, and there were lots of much younger people at this one. The sex balance was pretty heavily towards men. There were a few women. I didn't make a head count of women. They were kind of lost in the crowd, but that's typical. I don't know if there's been a significant increase in the number of women at AMREN over the four times that I've been, which has been over a 15-year period. But the one thing I really disagreed with in 2008 when Michael Walker spoke was his claim that it was a crying shame that every other seat wasn't filled with a woman. And I just thought that that's not a realistic expectation to have. This isn't a ballroom dancing class, right? It's a political movement. And women, I think, tend to hang back and stay away from radical politics, whereas I think that men naturally are drawn to that, and I don't think that's a problem. So I think that that simple fact of a sex ratio imbalance is not a sign that AMREN is doing anything wrong. However, I do think that as there is more momentum in the movement and as it becomes safer, there will be a greater percentage of women involved. And I just couldn't do a head count and I didn't have a baseline figure. I suspect that the percentage of women is creeping up at AMREN, but I just couldn't tell.
I could say that's definitely the case from my experience there last year. There was a definite increase as opposed to the time I went 6 years before that, and I went in 2002 as well. So I've that range to refer to. But it wasn't nearly as shocking as the downward trend in the average age of the attendees, though.
That was marked, yeah. About half the people there were under 35, and half the people there were there for their first AMREN conference. And I talked to a couple of people who came to the Countercurrents table who told me that this was not only their first AMREN conference, but their first in real life gathering of any sort connected with our movement. And that, I thought, was kind of remarkable. And I thought it was a great introduction. And they could have definitely done a lot worse than to come to an AMREN conference. But, you know, it takes an act of courage to come to these things for everybody involved. And one of the things I constantly stress to people who create content for the movement and are activists is that we should never lose sight of the fact that there was a time when it was an act of courage on our parts to just read things on the internet, much less go out to events. And as our audience grows, and it's growing dramatically, that means that there are a lot of people who are in that same position, who are constantly having to gin up a certain amount of courage to move forward into this. And we have to respect that fact. We have to be mindful of that. And it's especially a big act of courage to come out in a real world thing, a real world setting, much less invest a lot of money and time to go to a weekend conference. So those of you who came out for the very first time to anything, I congratulate you and I thank you. And I'm glad you had a good introduction to the movement, really one of the best introductions possible.
Well, speaking of the courage involved in coming to these things, what I've heard about it is that there was significantly more activity from the Antifa this time than at past events, and that apparently they actually managed to get into the conference venue on a few occasions. Did you experience any of that, or did you see it going on?
I saw it going on. There was a significantly increased population of these people over the last one, primarily because Donald Trump has gaslighted, or the leaders of the left have used Donald Trump to gaslight a lot of these people. As I said rather snarkily in my review, apparently federal funding for psychiatric medications has been slashed because there are a lot of
now there's a lot of self-medication probably.
That's a lot of self-medication too. There are a lot of people who definitely had an off their meds quality at this event. They also had some kind of sympathetic leftist judge. They went to court and demanded that they be allowed near the building, whereas in the past they'd been kept a distance away, and this judge allowed that to happen. So the state police were out in force. They were always really nice people, and they made me feel a lot safer. So there was
they were at the one I went to as well. In fact, I would almost say they seemed sympathetic, but I don't want to mistake friendliness for sympathy, but they certainly were more courteous than any other event I've been to.
Yeah, I think that's just Southern hospitality. These people are really, really nice. And the people at the actual the staff at the park, the people who worked at the hotel and conference center, were super nice people. And I always try and encourage an ethos of being the best possible guests, tipping well, being super polite and everything like that. And I would always thank the police and smile at them and things like that. Just be super friendly and tipped well at the meals, because we want them to want us to be there. And the tendency has been in the past, I'm told, for the people at the state park to think of Ameren as like the best guests they get every year. So I'm sure we kept up that tradition. Now, there were a couple of occasions where they were like coming up to the windows of the lobby outside the main conference room and peering in. But then they sort of, I don't know, and a couple of them came into the building and were like skulking around. But they were really scruffy and obvious. You know, it was obvious who they were. One of them was wearing a dress and it wasn't a woman. It was a freak show. It was a freak show, basically. Daryl Lamont Jenkins was there, you know, but he's hugely fat, and it was kind of a warm day. I think I was worried about him. I thought he might have a, you know, heat stroke or a heart attack or something. And I think a lot of them just sort of, they made made their presence known in the morning, and then they just went off to do other stuff, you know, shoot up or whatever these people do. But anyway, there was an occasion though on Saturday where one of the conference attendees was assaulted by these people.
I heard about that.
Yeah. And the protocol was not to engage them in any way, and Jared implored us not to do that. This guy had a ground floor room, and they were somewhere outside his room, and he went out on his balcony or something, or patio, and these people attacked him, basically. And they gave him a terrible black eye, and they threw him in the lake, and the police came and arrested him, believe it or not, and one of the Antifa. There were several others who engaged in the assault. I hope they have been arrested. We were worried about the poor guy, that he was going to have to be bailed out and everything. But apparently, a judge found that it was, or a magistrate, or whoever at the police station, state police station, decided that he should not be held, that he was a victim of a crime. And so he was released after he was medically treated, and he was back there the next day. I didn't get a chance to meet him. I didn't even know he was there until the whole thing was over. But yeah, that was a sour note. But otherwise, but it wasn't the fault of Jarrett Taylor or American Renaissance. It really was, to a small extent, the fault of the victim. He should not have engaged them in any way. And of course, it was primarily the fault of the criminals who attacked him. And frankly, I hope that this criminal assault will make it very difficult in the future for these people to get, let's say, favorable court rulings. Say that if Ameren happens at the same state park in the future, the fact that these people showed up and assaulted a person this year might make it very difficult for them to get the same access next year. And there might be increased security. Now, Ameren is looking for another facility that can hold a much larger crowd because, frankly, a much larger crowd would have been there if they had a bigger facility. So who knows where the next Ameren will be, but I know I'll be there.
I imagine they'll opt for some kind of federal government option, though, because I know the logic behind it is that they can't deny you your right to speak there, because then they'd be denying you your First Amendment rights, which I know is also the logic behind the NPI using the Ronald Reagan building in D.C.
Right. It's a state park in this case, but the same principle applies.
Right. I remember their first year going there, they actually went there because a venue in the D.C. area was pressured to cancel. And when they had to locate a new venue, they decided to find someplace, number one, that was government-owned for this reason of free speech and not being able to back out and back down the pressure, but also someplace that was a little bit outside of an urban area. I don't know if that's a moot point. This was before NPI started having its things at the Ronald Reagan building in D.C., but it'll be interesting to see if the organizers for next year's conference do decide to move it to a more urban area, if that brings out a larger contingent of protesters or if it stays about the same.
I actually have suggested that they do it at the Reagan building, and I'm sure that there will be a much larger contingent of these protesters if indeed they do it in Washington, D.C. I hope they do it there because that place can accommodate a very large crowd.
But I heard that they have said already that they will not host NPI at the Reagan building anymore because the amount of security that they can provide has exceeded, I guess, what they consider to be reasonable for a single event. So I've actually heard that the Reagan building has said they won't do it anymore. So I wonder if they would host Ameren either.
Yeah, that's too bad. I hadn't heard that.
Because, so, you know, things got really pretty nutty. I read this in several places because, you know, things got pretty crazy in D.C. last November.
Right.
Of course, that was just, what, 2 or 3 weeks after the election. But
it was 2 weekends after the election, yeah.
Right.
I wonder if there'll be some kind of legal challenge to that on the basis of First Amendment rights and everything.
That would be appropriate. I hope that happens. That would be an appropriate use of movement funds to challenge that, because the Ronald Reagan building is a really good facility for that. And honestly, there's some symbolic cachet of doing it right at the heart of Washington, D.C., right at the heart of the pause.
Most definitely.
Well, let's segue then, unless you guys want to toss in anything else. Let's segue to Dunkirk. Have you guys seen Dunkirk yet?
Yeah, Mike and I saw it 2 nights ago, actually.
What do you guys think?
Well, I actually kind of skimmed your review before I watched the movie itself, and basically was moved. I thought it was a powerful movie. It wasn't my favorite Christopher Nolan. That would have to be Inception. But as far as
Interstellar for me,
okay. But as far as the cinematography and being able to transport the viewer into this historical battle, it really did well, I thought. And I thought it also showed a lot of the coming together as a nation of the British people during that conflict. And was that your impression of that as well, John? Or?
Well, I liked the film a lot, but I felt like, you know, for me watching it, I mean, I'm no expert on the Second World War, but, you know, I had studied it, so I knew the background, and while I enjoyed the film very much, I found it almost bizarre how Nolan really went out of his way to deny it any sort of historical context, which is sort of what this one review on the Wall Street Journal that you guys referred me to was going on about. But it did seem very odd to me. Like, it reminded me, like, I know you could say that, well, of course, everyone would know that they were fighting the Germans, and the Germans were the National Socialists at the time, and so on and so forth. But I remember I went to see Valkyrie, you know, the film with Tom Cruise about the assassination attempt on Hitler in 1944 that I think came out in 2008 or 2009. And I saw it at a theater in Michigan. And I remembered realizing that after the bomb goes off, and at first the conspirators think that they've succeeded in killing Hitler, but then, of course, you know, they find out that he's still alive, and you know, their plot is spoiled. I realized that there were some people in the theater with me who were taken surprised by that. And I realized they probably didn't know that there was an assassination attempt on Hitler that failed prior to seeing that film. So, you know, in seeing Dunkirk, it struck me as a bit odd and almost Kafkaesque that they were determined. They never once said, you know, the Wall Street Journal article focused mainly on the fact that Churchill wasn't referenced, which, you know, that in itself is a bit odd. But also, you know, the words, you know, Nazi or German are never uttered once during the film. And of course, except for one of the very final shots of the film for just a moment, you never actually see any Germans. And it just struck me as kind of Kafkaesque, but kind of needlessly. Like, there's one scene where Kenneth Branagh's kind of joking around with one of the British soldiers who's waiting to get evacuated, and he says, like, oh, so do you want to wait around to be captured by the enemy or something like that? And I remember just thinking, like, well, surely, at that time, a British officer would have called them Jerrys. I mean, that was their nickname for the Germans. I don't think he would have said the enemy. So, I don't know. It struck me as odd the degree to which they were willing to go to deny any sort of historical context to the film. You know, to the point that even when the Germans were shooting at them, you know, except for a couple of the German planes, you know, which they had to show. I mean, it would have been bizarre without that. But like the scene when they're in the boat and the Germans are shooting at the boats, the beached vessel, and they figure out that the Germans are shooting for target practice, but you never actually see the Germans who are shooting at them. And it just, over the course of the film, and I didn't fully realize this until a while after I'd left the theater, but it really was very strange. I thought the degree to which they went to deny it that sort of context. I mean, it was a very good film. It was very well made, and it was very tense. Well, except for the scene where the guy whose Spitfire has run out of fuel shoots down a German bomber, which I just thought was ridiculous. But other than that, I thought the film was really well made. But I don't know that I really personally appreciate this sort of removal of history. I mean, it seems very sort of postmodern and millennial to me, you know, to make this film, actually name it Dunkirk, you know, about a very crucial historical event, and then, you know, completely remove any sort of historical context from it. And I kind of agree with this Wall Street Journal journalist who says it's just because, you know, as soon as people realize they're watching a film about history, they kind of roll their eyes and get bored, you know, or most audiences today. And if that's really what Nolan was going for, I don't know. I'm not saying there should have been, you know, lectures on the significance of the evacuation or anything like that, but it just seems like they could have at least given some acknowledgement to the fact that this was just a piece of a much larger struggle. Did either of you feel that way, or did you think it wasn't as big of a problem?
I didn't think it was a problem. I thought it was one of the film's virtues, because what that Wall Street Journal reviewer, journalist, whatever, was really demanding is that this film be another anti-German morality tale. And a pro-Churchill morality tale, right? And I was grateful for that. I did not want to go see another movie about what horrible people the Germans were. I wanted to see this movie because, first of all, it was by Christopher Nolan. That's the main reason I wanted to see it. And second, because it was an interesting episode in the war, and I was shocked and pleased that it wasn't just a conventional moralistic film about the Second World War, that what it was really about was about England. And frankly, the English could have been fighting space aliens, and the message would have been the same. It was all about the coming together of this organic nation. And it was a movie about the masses. It reminded me of King Vidor's The Crowd, but in a positive rather than in a negative light. It's a movie about the English masses and their solidarity, how they came together. It does not have any cabinet scenes. It doesn't have any Churchill, you know, people playing Churchill. There's one guy reading from one of Churchill's speeches on a train near the end, but unless you knew the speech, you wouldn't even know that it was Churchill. It focuses on the British people. It focuses on the masses, and it focuses on white men, because the Britons were white people. And yes, the politically correct are complaining that it doesn't have any black or WOG or whatever troops, you know.
You see a black French soldier in once, early on, just for a moment.
His frightened face, just for a sec. But yeah, there were black colonial troops and Indian colonial troops and things like that were pressed into service. But this was about England, right? These people were bit players in a war between England and Germany, and this was really about England. And I just thought it was terribly moving. It was terribly moving to see these different storylines, all of which involved entirely English people, except for the one on the beach where there was a French guy who was trying to escape by dressing up in a British uniform. But, you know, they were all white guys, and they were all dealing with this horrible, horrible situation as best they could. And in the end, it was just emotionally very, very powerful. What was your emotional reaction as the movie came to its climax, Mike? Did this wring a tear from your eye?
Yeah, it did, actually. Towards the end, just the power of it. It uses Elgar's Nimrod variation, and that is just a tremendously emotive piece of music for me, just listening to it with no context. But in the context they happened to bring it into the movie, we saw that the boat that was sailing to Dunkirk to perform this rescue was not alone. It was part of this larger flotilla of civilian vessels going in there, and that really just showed the solidarity of the British people in that hour. And you felt this sense of impending doom throughout the movie, that you could finally see light at the end of the tunnel in that moment. And I think they were very effective.
That music is so quintessentially English.
Yes.
Right? You know, it is English, and it's incredibly moving and sentimental. And to have that emerge out of this industrial, electronic, crashing Hans Zimmer score was really a surprise. And I was floored by it. I just thought, oh, this is perfection. There's no better shift in the that I could have conceived of in the music at that point. I thought it was brilliant. John, how did the climax of the film affect you?
Oh, I love that as well. The only negative thing I can say, and I hate to find myself agreeing with Bill Kristol on anything, but I would agree with one thing that he wrote in his review, which is that, you know, it's hard to imagine that such a thing would be possible today. Yeah, you know, I'm not so sure about England, but certainly in America, I mean, I couldn't imagine civilians coming together like that for the sake of their country in a in a wartime situation. But it just kind of reminds us of what we've lost, at least for me. But it was a brilliant sequence. I thought it was extremely well done.
Yeah, it's a very, very sentimental movie about home, basically. And I loved it. I just thought, and it's different. It's so different from, like I said, the standard contemporary World War II movie with all of its preachiness. And, you know, not a year goes by without some major film with some guy with jowls, you know, giving Winston Churchill's speeches and grimacing and chomping on cigars. It was a relief not to have to endure another Churchill. Apparently there's a big movie coming out this fall with Gary Oldman as Churchill, and I'll actually go see that just because I like Gary Oldman. I think it's called Finest Hour or something, which is set at the very same time. So we'll see. Well, the Wall Street Journal will finally get the movie it asked for.
Well, I just to clarify what I meant, I mean, I don't believe there should have been scenes with Churchill and with a, you know, with a cartoon Hitler, you know, foaming at the mouth or anything like that. I mean, I just thought it was weird that they had to, like, they just said the enemy. They couldn't say the Germans or the Jerrys or something.
The space aliens. That's what,
yeah.
There was one reference to Jerry's in the boat that was beached. Okay. But that was it. At least I heard that. But yeah, there was no reference to the Nazis, to the Germans. I didn't see a swastika. They really could have been fighting space aliens. And that was actually kind of refreshing because it sort of took the spotlight away from the World War II morality play that we've been taught to expect from every movie that comes out and just shown it on something different, something very, very new, really in these movies. And it was very touching.
At the very end, you did see the aviator, the English aviator, get captured by German soldiers.
Just
you more or less you can see their helmets. Yeah.
They're kind of out of focus and
silhouetted.
Yeah, that's all you see. And I just thought that was, cinematically, that was a kind of brilliant move, in my opinion. It was really kind of brilliant. So,
and well, maybe I'll feel differently on a second viewing.
Right.
We'll see.
Another thing that really struck me about this movie is how short it is by Christopher Nolan standards. I think it's his second shortest movie after his very first movie, which he did sort of as a student following. I think this is his second shortest movie. It's basically a little more than an hour and 40 minutes long, which is quite something after, you know, Inception and Interstellar and the Dark Knight movies. It's very different from what we've come to expect from Nolan. It doesn't have a lot of dialogue. It doesn't have a lot of characterization, character development. Most of the people in the movie have no names, which emphasizes the collective quality that he's trying to bring out as well. And even the big name stars, like, again, the guy who, I'm blanking out his name.
Tom Hardy,
yeah. He's a huge star and he doesn't get major billing. He has hardly any lines. I guess he loves having a mask over his face now. This is the third movie in which he's had a mask on his face practically the whole time. And I didn't even know it was him until the very end. I just think this is kind of interesting. Cillian Murphy was in it. I recognized him, but he had a minor role too. So you had a few big name actors with minor roles. Most of the actors with speaking parts were unknowns or minor actors, and they were all good. And most of the characters in the actual movie don't have names, which I just thought was fascinating. So again, it emphasizes the collective struggle, basically.
Know nothing about the characters before, nothing about their background whatsoever. I don't think about any.
No.
You know, like, it's traditional in sort of classic war films about the Second World War that, you know, while they're having lunch or something, the soldiers will discuss, like, oh, well, you know, I'm from Wyoming or, you know, wherever. And then,
right.
But you didn't get any of that in this film. I mean, the soldiers all seem kind of traumatized. Well, like, you know, they were only focused on survival. They didn't really care anything about about where anybody else came from or anything like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were too traumatized for chit chat and background stuff. And again, I was so glad that he didn't give in to that narrative kind of cliche of war films. The structure of the movie was musical in a way, and I mentioned this in my review. It was like a huge musical fugue. For one thing, you had three storylines that were constantly being cut back and forth between one another, and you didn't have character development or plot development so much as you had, well, the elements were character and plot, but it was more like just this great war as aesthetic phenomenon experience. It reminded me of it made me think of the kind of movies that the Italian futurists would have done, right down to the roaring machines and industrial music and so forth. But also, it made me think of Ernst Jünger as well, who treated battle as a kind of vast aesthetic experience. It really was an incredible aestheticization, a musical kind of aestheticization of the war, rather than a conventional war story. And that makes it a really extraordinarily avant-garde accomplishment. I mean, this movie's made $200 million already, and it's going to make a hell of a lot more money as people flock to see it. But it's one of the more avant-garde movies I've seen in a long time, and an astonishingly successful piece of avant-garde cinema when you get right down to it.
Yeah, that's true. The only thing that I read a few articles about historical accuracy, and the only thing that bothered me about it was that the fact that at the end, Tom Hardy's character, you know, the pilot, shoots down that German plane after his plane has run out of fuel. And that was the only moment in the film where I kind of groaned inwardly, because I was like, oh, come on, that's not... I've actually read in articles that apparently it's theoretically possible that a Spitfire, once it's run out of fuel, can coast for up to 100 miles, even without fuel. So it's possible that for it to remain flying, but you know, you wouldn't have the control over it.
The ability to maneuver in battle, yeah.
So that scene where he shoots down the plane, I was like, well, was that really necessary? But I don't know. It's the only moment in the film that struck me as, you know, overly romanticized and kind of
ringing false. Yeah.
Otherwise, I thought it was very very convincing.
You know, the review that I wrote of it's been read more than 15,000 times now. It got linked by Tyler Cowen's Marginal Revolution blog. And that's a place where a lot of people who sort of fancy themselves really, really clever and who are into libertarian economics and alt-light kind of concerns hang out. And so it was a big boost. I think he's linked me as Trevor Lynch once before, and that was way back when I reviewed Inglourious Basterds, actually. And that gave a nice little bump and a bit of a buzz, and I think that that's the main reason why I got a lot of traffic. But then there is this piece by this Bloom character at National Review that actually links the Countercurrents piece as well and refers to the Marginal Revolution link. And it reminds me that as much as I wish I could write articles about Nietzsche and Heidegger and Plato for the rest of my life, or articles about how to organize the right and things like that, that consistently the stuff that I've written that gets read the most and therefore works as a tool of outreach the best are reviews of movies. It's kind of humbling, but that's just the reality of the situation.
They're fun.
Well,
right,
I mean, metapolitics is all about influencing culture. And, you know, films are definitely popular cultures. So,
and the reason
intelligent.
Yeah, the reason why all these films are jam-packed with propaganda is they are one of the most effective ways of propagandizing the public mind. And if there's anything that we can do to use them as teachable moments to teach our outlook on things, to teach people how to decode propaganda, that's being spoon-fed them, or it's not even being spoon-fed anymore, it's just being blasted at them at ear-splitting volume, to teach people how to see through that suddenly makes these things reinforce our message rather than the establishment message. And as I put it before, that is the best kind of asymmetrical warfare, where they invest billions and billions of dollars pumping propaganda through their media, and we invest the amount of that it costs to keep a website going in order to help teach people to see through what they're doing. That is terribly effective asymmetrical warfare. And in this case, really, the movie was just so un-PC. It's really an un-PC film, and a lot of the reviewers are snorting angry about that. Why are there not more women? Well, there were women, but they were doing what women did. They were nurses, and they were women handing out bread with jelly on it.
Red Cross workers.
Yeah, exactly. That's what women did, and a lot of women did that, and a lot of women died in that war doing those sorts of duties. So they were shown. Where were all the indispensable non-whites? Well, there weren't any indispensable non-whites in the war, to be perfectly honest.
I read there were a few hundred Indian troops that fought with the British who were at Dunkirk. But if you consider a few hundred out of 300,000 that were being evacuated, that's less than a fraction of a percent.
Yeah.
But it's a credit to Nolan that he didn't make one of the main characters, you know, a gay Sikh.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I was very pleased that he did not go the PC route. He is definitely one of the least PC filmmakers around. And that's good. Of course, he does have who plays Lucius Fox in the Dark Knight trilogy. He's typecast as God. I keep forgetting the guy's name, oddly enough. But other than a few things like
Morgan
Freeman? Yes,
right.
Yeah. I've been meaning to write an essay on his career called "Typecast as God." Morgan Freeman's career, but I can't dislike Morgan Freeman. He's just perfectly fine in that role. It's just he's playing an extreme outlier, is what he's playing. But you know, honestly, he's one of the least PC filmmakers around, and he's enormously influential now. I really think he's one of the best living filmmakers we've got, and that's high praise.
Certainly of the younger generation.
Yeah.
And I know we've talked about it extensively before, but I just thought Interstellar was fantastic.
You know, I haven't written anything about Interstellar, and I really want to. Maybe we should do a film podcast about Interstellar, and that will actually essay. It'll wring an essay out of me about Interstellar if we do that.
Sure. Yeah, I would enjoy that.
Interstellar is an incredibly touching film, and it's very interesting. His movies get to be more emotionally powerful, I think, as they go along. Interstellar was an incredibly emotionally powerful film. This was an incredibly emotionally powerful film. The Dark Knight Rises was very, very emotionally powerful. It wasn't just a comic book film. It had a lot of emotional drama to it. And before that, Inception was a shattering film. Just shattering.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah.
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 So,
in all of his films, though, even, you know, this one was short, but even in his longer ones, I just kind of am drawn in and lose all sense of time. So when the movie's done, it could be 3 hours or it could be not quite two. It's still just been an emotional experience that I've been drawn into when I watch a Christopher Nolan film. So
yeah,
let's not forget Memento. Also, I was lucky. I saw it in the theater in the year 2000 at the recommendation of a friend, and that's still a very emotionally powerful film. I mean, it's one of the most tragic films I can think of. I mean, you really feel the tragedy of his situation at the end when you realize what's been going on the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, that's a brilliant film. It's his first really brilliant film, I think, and I do like a great deal Insomnia and The Prestige, but
I haven't seen that one.
They're clever. They're incredibly clever. They're incredibly well made. but they for some reason lack the emotional wallop of his very best films. So
Insomnia, actually, you know, that's based on a Swedish film, and I actually found the Swedish version even better.
Wow. Well, I'd like to see that.
It's even colder, if you can imagine that, than the because the main character is a lot less sympathetic than Al Pacino is in Nolan's version. But
it's so much more emotionally complex a plot than, again, any other cop movie of its type. It just doesn't have the depths. It doesn't have the layers. It doesn't have the emotional, the dramatic conflict and the emotional payoff. You know, that he puts on the screen in Insomnia. So he's a great filmmaker for complex plots. And in this case, well, the characterization element is almost absent, and yet it still manages to be incredibly powerful because it's a movie not about individuals. It's a movie about the masses. But there's something to be said about that. For the
maybe
masses.
It's a little bit like Eisenstein in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Masses are sort of the main character rather than
the people. It's a very populist film, but hey, we're populists too.
Right.
Well, hey, let's we've been going for nearly an hour now, so let's just segue into our final little segment, which is Shop Talk. We talked a lot about upcoming projects, and that list hasn't really changed, but Mike, you're now working on this volume called The Countercurrents Interviews, the first volume of Countercurrents Interviews. Do you want to share some of your thoughts on it? And Mike, you're one of the editors of it. You wrote the foreword to it as well. So why don't you guys share a little bit about this project? I'm sure our readers and listeners will be very interested.
Well, I put some work into it several months ago, and then I pretty much handed it off to John, who's been working on it more recently. But yeah, the book is about the Countercurrents radio interviews we did back when Countercurrents was still in its infancy in 2012. We just completed 2 years, and we were starting January 2012. And when we got started with it, Greg, you kind of handed it off to me as, you know, my area of domain, because I had all the technical background for doing the editing with the various software, sound editing, and getting it online and everything. And so kind of hit the ground running with it in the beginning of 2012. I wanted to have a speaker who was somewhat controversial, but also somebody who's outside of our normal movement circles as our first interviewee. And prior to that, Greg, you had written an article analyzing Yoav Shamir's Defamation, his film Defamation. Yoav Shamir is an Israeli filmmaker who caught the ire of the Anti-Defamation League for this particular film. His history, he's done several documentary films, but this one was the film I think that got him the most notoriety, and definitely how we came to first learn about him. But I reached out to him and managed to set up an interview with the three of us as our first. And after that, as our second interview, we had Kevin McDonald. So, you know, two people who have something to say about anti-Semitism and defamation. So,
yeah. So remind me and tell the listeners, who were the interviewees in this first volume? John, well, if you want to jump in, you can, if you've got it in front of you.
I don't have it in front of me, so John, you should go ahead and read them off.
Well, we also have Mark Dial in what I consider a very fascinating interview. I mean, he's still in contact with us, and he still wants to work with us, but he's been pretty quiet the last couple of years.
Yeah, but it's because he's got a little boy, and he's just been really focused on his education. He's homeschooling now.
Right.
And that's taking a big chunk of his time. I actually had dinner with him this past Monday after I got back to Atlanta from the Amarin conference. So we had a really nice conversation. And, you know, he's still reading and watching and listening and thinking and learning, but he's also homeschooling, and that's just a massive, massive investment of his time. So he wants to get back into writing more. But yeah, that's a fascinating interview that we did with Mark.
He really explains, you know, his whole trajectory from, you know, going from, you know, a university student who majored in black studies to getting involved with the ultras in Italy and becoming more sympathetic to Casa Pound and, you know, Italian neo-fascism and so forth. So it's, yeah, I really found that interesting. And also in there is Greg, your conversation. Well, Mike, you're on this one as well. The conversation with Charles Kraft. And
yes,
that's really, you know, also, you know, he kind of explains his story, you know, how he developed as an artist and his involvement with Laibach, how he sort of, well, I guess he kind of says in the interview that he doesn't really consider himself to be right or left, but, you know, sort of came around to being sympathetic to our way of looking at things.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's a very interesting interview in itself. And there's two interviews with Vox Day in there, one of which, Greg, you did with him following the publication of his conservative book.
Yeah.
And the other one is from SJW's Always Lie from that period.
Right. There's a Jack Donovan interview, right? We included
right,
that.
That's the only other one we haven't mentioned yet. Yeah. Oh no, actually, there's also there's Jack Donovan, and there's also Thomas Goodrich and Gilad Atzmon as well.
Yeah, the Goodrich interview was very good. I really like that, and Atzmon too. And so a number of these were interviews where Mike and I interviewed the guy together. It was and then a couple of them are ones where I just, with Vox Day and Gilad Atzmon, I just did it on my own. And the Goodrich interview, does that have Matt Parrott on it too?
It does.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. So anyway, it was a collaborative effort, and it's called The Countercurrents Interviews Volume 1, and it is edited by Mike Polignano and Greg Johnson. And once John puts the finishing touches on it, we'll fire it out there in transcript form. And we'll also fire out an audiobook of it so you can hear it in a new context. And that's one of the reasons why we do this. We did these interviews years ago when our listenership, viewership, readership was a fraction of what it is today. And so these are really good, and they deserve a new audience, a bigger audience. And so we're going to bring them back to a much bigger audience.
Yeah, I think people will find these quite interesting. I finished proofreading it now, and I'm just checking the transcriptions against the original audio, and I've still got a couple of those left to do, but then that'll be completely done.
Great, great. So that'll probably be out this month or maybe at the beginning of September. So, guys, I think that's good. We've gone for a little more than an hour now, and we don't want to have too much of an editing project to just dump in Mike's lap because he's still quite good at all this technical stuff. So let's wrap it up here, and we'll be back next week for another weekly episode of Countercurrents Radio.
See you all next week.
Sounds good. Take care, you guys.